From the Meridian Manufacturing Studios, you're listening to Inside Agriculture. While a top tax issue for farmers and ranchers is dividing the Democratic presidential ticket, it's not just Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton that disagree on the estate tax, as Trump wants it gone and Clinton wants it increased. But Clinton's running mate, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, also took a position on the tax as former Virginia governor. Former USDA Ag Secretary in the Reagan administration, John Block, said this in a recent radio program.
Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate, spoke out a few years ago saying, and I quote, "I applaud lawmakers for repealing Virginia's estate tax. This action protects small businesses and farms," end of quote.
Trump running mate and Indiana Governor Mike Pence won an end to his state's estate tax in 2013. But Hillary Clinton wants to reduce the estate tax exemption from more than $5 million down to $3.5 million, as well as raise the tax rate to 45% from the current 40%. She charges that Trump's tax proposals favor the rich. Block argues the federal government collects less than one-half of 1% of its tax revenues from the estate tax. Farm groups argue producers are land rich but cash poor, and many have to break up the farm to pay the tax. House Republicans passed an estate tax repeal last year, only to see their effort blocked by Senate Democrats. Ohio Representative Steve Stivers.
The death tax conflicts with the American dream, and it is inherently unfair. The death tax hurts family businesses, family farmers, and ranchers. In fact, according to the Joint Economic Committee, the death tax hurts economic growth and activity by discouraging savings and small business growth. It represents a tiny fraction of federal revenue, but its impact on families is enormous.
And the estate tax exemption this year is nearly $5.5 million per individual, nearly $11 million per married couple. Many Democrats say that's enough to pass on a small business. Many farmers and ranchers disagree. Well, we're going to take a break here. Now, when we come back, the National Corn Growers Association received a large grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it's used to develop a system for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture and business sectors. We're going to talk about that when we come back. Definitely some information you're going to want to know about. It's coming up right after this. As we continue on with Inside Agriculture from the Meridian Manufacturing Studios, the National Corn Growers Association received a large grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to develop a system for scalable carbon accounting in agriculture. The goal of the new program is to optimize farm profitability, reduce greenhouse gases, and improve agronomic productivity. The program is set up to establish a carbon in-setting framework, and Dr. Nick Gaser, Director of the Soil Health and Sustainability for the National Corn Growers, talked about what that actually means.
We can think of that as similar to carbon offsetting, but in this case, it would be paying farmers directly to implement conservation practices, planting cover crops, like using minimum tillage, to build organic matter and sequester carbon.
And they chose the route of carbon insetting as a more direct way to incentivize farmers to keep doing practices they're probably already doing on their farms now. Now, one of the results of a program like this is carbon neutrality. And Gaser talked about the definition and what it means for companies who want to be carbon neutral.
Carbon neutrality, if a company, a consumer packaged good company or an input supplier, makes a carbon neutrality claim, it means that in production of their good, whether it's a seed, whether it's a chemical, herbicide, insecticide, something like that, when they produce that, they're saying that they're going to do it with a net zero emission of carbon or carbon equivalent. What this means for farmers is that, say, in this case, we're working with Monsanto in this project. Monsanto has their carbon neutral commitment. They say they're going to go net zero. And what it means for farmers is farmers are going to receive an incentive to use practices that would build carbon in their soils to have that insetting and reduce the carbon emissions from agricultural production.
Kayser said there are several advantages to a program like this for both consumers and retailers.
I think there are several advantages, both from the consumer side and from the ag retailer side. First, from the consumer side, consumers can benefit from knowing that we're working together throughout this ag supply chain. Farmers directly with companies across the supply chain, we're working together to improve agricultural sustainability, to make sure that the food that ends up on everybody's plate is healthy, nutritious, and produced in the most sustainable way. And also along with that, that this incentive framework can provide a means for which companies can make valid, credible carbon commitments, carbon neutrality commitments, towards societal benefit by reducing greenhouse gas emissions from their production, but then also from agricultural production as well.
Now, this is designed to help everyone in the supply chain be more environmentally friendly in the production of consumer goods.
The goal of this framework would be to link a company making a carbon neutral claim. If they can't meet that carbon neutrality goal on their own, they can work directly with farmers so that the farmers could capture carbon, and that overall the whole supply chain or across farmers and the company, that we would have a net zero carbon emission. With farmers using cover crops and no-till or strip-till, minimum tillage in general, we know that we can build organic matter, and as part of that organic matter, that's going to be soil carbon, and sequestering that carbon in the soil removes it from the atmosphere. That helps in reducing greenhouse gases.
Now, the Soil Health Partnership will get half of the USDA grant and will play a role in developing this program.
Working across our network, right now we have 70 locations spread across 9 upper Midwestern states. Most of these locations, 65 of the 70 locations, are on-farm trials, working directly with farmers to try out new practices like cover crops, like minimum tillage, but then also trying different practices with nutrient management. So with this proposal, with this framework, we'll have the opportunity to invite farmers in this network to really try it out, try to get their hands into it and see what kind of feedback they have for the framework. Does the verification make sense? Does it help with economic profitability, getting extra dollars from that same acre of production? And what other incentives might be needed to use practices like cover crops, like strip-till or no-till, in combination with their good agricultural production practices that they already have in place.
Dr. Gazer also manages the Soil Health Partnership. Partner organizations in the project include AgSolver, Applied GeoSolutions, DNDC Art, Monsanto, Climate Smart Group, and Crop Growers. We'll take a break here, but when we come back, TPP. You heard of it? That's next. From the Meridian Manufacturing Studios, you're listening to Inside Agriculture on 910 Classic Country, KCJB in Minot, Ag News 890, Lisbon and Fargo, and Farm News in Real Country, Thunder 106.1, also Lisbon and Fargo. While Canadian dairy pricing policies have caught the attention of congressional members, as well as the National Milk Producers Federation, Canada recently announced a new national ingredient strategy and already has an active Class 6 Ontario pricing program. Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer of New York and Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin say the program incentivizes Canadian processors to use Canadian milk and inputs while penalizing processors that use imported dairy products. National Milk Producers Vice President of Communications Chris Galen said the Canadian market is typically very tight, but more dairy products have made their way into the market over the last few years.
In recent years, though, the U.S. has been able to export some filtered milk from places like Wisconsin, also New York State, that is used primarily in cheese there, and it's priced at a discount to Canada's own milk proteins, and so Canadian cheese companies and other processors have been able to avail themselves of the U.S. product because our prices tend to be lower than theirs.
The Canadian government now wants to change the pricing structure of some of the Canadian milk that could be used in cheese manufacturing and make it more price competitive with American products.
In fact, give the domestic milk in Canada an advantage over our own. So this is something that is already beginning to happen. There's going to be some more formal discussions this fall on finalizing this approach, but we've already heard from companies on this side of the border that they've lost some export sales, and we're really concerned that this could become a permanent policy in Canada.
Galen said this move by Canada is likely a trade agreement violation, either with the World Trade Organization or the North American Free Trade Agreement.
I think it's potentially a WTO violation or even a NAFTA violation. That was certainly the point that was raised by Tammy Baldwin, who along with Senator Chuck Schumer of New York had written recently to our elected officials, to Michael Froman, who's the U.S. Trade Representative, and Tom Vilsack, saying, hey, you guys got to look into this situation because this is impeding dairy trade between the U.S. and Canada and a potential violation of Canada's commitments to the U.S.
Now, speaking of trade, Galen said the Trans-Pacific Partnership isn't dead in the water, but
I think that it is on life support for 2016. I think a lot of the farm groups are very frustrated that despite our efforts here to raise the importance of this issue with our elected officials and trying to get something done, that I think just because of the campaign season that we're in, that you're hearing about a lot in Wisconsin and other states, Iowa as well, trade is a hot topic. It's been, I think, unfairly blamed for some of the challenges that various industries have had, particularly in the upper Midwest and the Rust Belt. And so all that reflects back on TPP. I think that there's probably a slight chance that it could come up in a lame duck session, depending on who is elected president.
And overproduction of milk has led to lower prices recently, but they've been bouncing more up than down lately. Galen said the dairy market's starting to work itself out.
And I do think you're seeing evidence of that because certainly cheese prices, which are now, well, depending on barrels or blocks, there's actually a 10-cent per pound difference, with blocks being about 10 cents higher than barrels. But certainly both of those are around 30 cents higher than what they were 6 months ago, and that's certainly very good news there.
National Milk Producers Federation Vice President of Communications, Chris Galen. Well, we're going to take a break here. However, when we come back, we're going to talk about pork exports. That's coming your way next. Well, as we wrap up what's going on inside agriculture, pork exports for the first 7 months of 2016 is equal to about 25% of U.S. pork production. Pork Checkoff Vice President of International Marketing, Becca Neppel, says that trend has been pretty stable in recent years.
The last 4 years, we've had at least 24% of our production going overseas. So what we saw through July of this year is value is down 2% compared to the same period in 2015, and volume is up 3%. So that just tells you the currency issues that are going on internationally, that U.S. pork has to compete with a cheaper product, honestly, from the EU, from Canada, even from Brazil.
U.S. pork export volumes are higher year over year. Neppel says that's happening in a very competitive market environment.
A lot of the challenges, especially for U.S. pork, last year's West Coast port slowdown, while we've recovered from that and product is flowing internationally through the ports, we lost a lot of trust with some of our major customers. So we have a real job of rebuilding trust with some of our, especially Asian customers, as well as the currency issues. Our product has been priced higher than a lot of our competitors. With the Russian closure, we saw steep competition come in from the EU, who were exporting a lot of product to Russia. And then, of course, we always have tariff and non-tariff barriers to exporting. So there's always a set of challenges ahead of us and behind us.
And Neppel says China and Hong Kong are continuing to drive the export business for U.S. pork. Well, as we wrap up what's going on inside agriculture, farmers and ranchers cut their production costs by roughly 9% last year. A report on successful farming said the cuts were caused by an end to the agricultural boom and a resulting collapse in farm income. Farmers paid out a total of $362.8 billion last year. That's the lowest outlay since 2012, according to estimates from the USDA Farm Expenditures Report. That's Inside Agriculture. I'm Farm Director Terry Loomis.